Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Music historians generally agree that Western opera began around the turn of the 17th century in Europe. However, the modern repertoire has generally ignored the first 150 years or so in favor of the works of the mid-19th century to the early 20th century. Think of people like Puccini, Verdi, and Wagner. They're the ones who get a lot of attention.
It has only been in the last few decades that the earlier operas have been gaining a wider audience. The Florentine Opera is staging two early English operas this weekend, Venus and Adonis by John Blow and Dido and Aeneas by Henry Purcell. It is a fairly recent development that the Florentine has dipped its toe into the Baroque opera waters. They started in 2009 with a production of Handel's Semele.
This double bill this weekend is being led from the harpsichord by Great Lakes Baroque founder Jory Vinokur. It's the first time the Florentine has actually used a period orchestra comprised of Baroque period instruments rather than modern ones. WUWM's audio engineer Jason Reavy and I took a trip up to Florentine's rehearsal space in River West to meet Vinokur, along with artistic director Bill Florescu and mezzo-soprano Sandra Pekes-Eddie, who is singing the role of Dido. Pekes-Eddie began by explaining the significance this role has had in her career.
I heard Dido's Lament in a form and analysis class at Boston Conservatory when I was an undergrad music education major. So I had some voice lessons during the week, but I didn't have any idea. I had no idea what opera was at that time. I loved musical theater. So when I was in this room listening to Dr. Bell play Janet Baker's recording of Dido's Lament, he was trying to just demonstrate what a ground bass was. So I heard this music and immediately was taken by the feeling that was behind it, the word painting, the way the singer used her voice like an instrument. It spoke to me. And honestly, that afternoon I went to the library and I got the recording and I listened to it on a record maybe a dozen times over and over and over again. I was just in love with opera because of Janet Baker singing Dido's Lament.
And you get to finally sing it.
I do get to finally sing it. It's a dream. It's a dream come true.
It is one of the most famous arias, certainly in Baroque opera, but mm-hmm. in all of opera. And Jory, give us a little history of this piece and where this aria fits in. Was opera changing at that particular time?
Opera was certainly changing, and opera was a great novelty in England to such a point that it's very difficult to know whether we can define our two works, Venus and Adonis by John Blow and Dido and Aeneas of Henry Purcell, as fully fledged operas, or are they masks? We find a manuscript about one century after the composition of Dido, but somebody has recopied this and written Dido and Aeneas a mask. So these are semi-theatrical pieces. They may have been performed with the acts interspersed with spoken text, and yet today, 350-some-odd years later, we do definitely perceive them as operas with a tragic story being told with music, thorough composed. So they're terribly important, and especially important in the history of English language opera.
And so, Bill, you've done Baroque opera here before. Why put these two together? What was it about these two? Is it because of that historical import?
It was. I mean, when I decided to do, Dido was my starting point, and I wanted to pair it up. And because of the connection between Purcell and Blow as composers, but also the fact that Purcell was sort of inspired structurally by what Blow had done with Venus and Adonis, and then also from a more pragmatic standpoint, being able to double cast the roles all except for Dido. It just made a lot of sense, the length of the works, everything about it, I thought made a really wonderful evening together. So it was. It also gave me a chance to scratch my very rudimentary musicological itch that I have. So it was fun to do the research on it.
Dig into it and find
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
Were you going to jump in?
I was going to say, it's also pretty, it's great that there's also reference to Venus in Dido and Aeneas. So you'll hear the word.
Aeneas is the son of Venus.
When you're setting this up, and this is a question for all of you, when you're doing a work like this that isn't what we think of as a fully dramatic work, say, like Tosca, how do you inject, besides the music, how do you inject the drama?
I sort of, and I don't think it's even a contrarian view anymore, but I sort of reject the notion that they're not, by their nature, dramatic. I think both of these works have... You know, yes, there's gods and goddesses and nymphs and shepherds and all of that, but the relationships, particularly sort of building backwards from each piece, both end with these beautiful dirge choruses, and you have to believe them because otherwise, it just I think it's an unsatisfying evening. So I sort of build backwards from those final choruses, and you have to inject reality into it. And the writing is so wonderful that the relationships are there. So we do have some places where we buy into the formality of it, particularly in the dance portions. But aside from that, I feel that they're very, very flesh and blood. I think that's a starting point for me.
I absolutely agree with Bill. I notice in both operas there are crucial scenes which transpire off stage, if you will, whether it's Adonis being killed by a wild boar. We don't see any part of that action. We find Adonis dying in the arms of Venus after a rather amusing interlude with Cupid and the little Cupids learning about love. And yet I agree with Bill, these are absolutely flesh and blood characters. Mm-hmm. They were meant to touch to the heart at the time this was written, 1683 or so. And a couple of years later for Dido, and I think they still touch us today.
Everybody's talking about the relationships, but that's exactly the first thing that I thought of with these relationships. You see with, let's say, with Belinda and Dido, she's trying to help her at the very beginning of the opera. She's pressed with torment. She's laden with sadness. But when you hear it in the music, it's just slightly different every time we sing it, or we hope it's slightly different every time we sing a repeat. So we're trying to flesh out the characters a little bit. For me, my challenge or the thing that I really get excited about is really finding vulnerability in this very strong, seemingly strong woman, and fleshing that out where it's not just one color all the time, where she is the Queen of Carthage, but she has very real emotion. She's a
human
really
human.
Yeah, she's a woman.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a certain formality in the music too, but the Baroque also, and we've talked about this in other interviews, where there's this room for expression. Mm-hmm. You have certain structures that are very real, but there's a lot of room on top of it.
And this is very interesting. I think I addressed a very brief opinion the first day of rehearsal, but Dido, in fact, is in a sense a very brief role, and she expresses her emotions over two great ground-based pieces. And Sandy mentioned towards the beginning of this interview being carried away by the lament, which is built on a chromatically descending ground bass. And this is going to be fleshed out and harmonized with a famous tune that we're going to hear in a moment. But the first thing we hear from Dido is another repetitive bass where she sings of her anguish and she cannot express her torment. Of course, she's just in love with the handsome visitor. So to have a bookend of one ground bass trying to find meaning, and then the final very dirge-like funeral ground bass. I think this is fascinating. It's formalistic, but so moving.
It is, and it allows you in that wonderful lament to really be so expressive.
Expressive, absolutely.
And it's there supporting you, mm-hmm. doing that. let's do a little bit of music geek techiness here for a minute. Talk a little bit about ground bass and what that means in Baroque music in general.
It's interesting to note that in French Baroque opera this time, I'm thinking principally of Jean-Baptiste Lully, most of his operas, if not all of them, will feature at some point a chaconne, which is another type of repetitive bass piece. The most famous is perhaps from Armide, which is another type of tragedy, where you'll get the chorus and dance and some soloists over this constantly repeating piece, yet very kaleidoscopic. Purcell uses this rather differently. So the English ground bass has its own character. It is quite unusual. We don't find it in John Blow's Venus. We just find it in Purcell to have two big vocally based ground basses.
And so musically, it is a phrase that just repeats.
The bass phrase repeats. The harmonies are constantly transforming and modulating over this. And I find this very kaleidoscopic. There is a fixed bass, and yet what happens over that bass can develop and be very different, including the singer's melody, of course, but also the harmonies underlaying that melody.
When you step into Baroque opera versus a more classical role, mm-hmm. what do you change, if anything?
It's funny, I was thinking about this morning, actually, when I've sung Popea before, and I remember singing it overseas, and the rest of the cast were Baroque specialists. So a lot of the countertenors only sang Baroque opera, and I remember thinking, I feel like I want to be part of this club, you know, because I felt so, I had such adoration, like I just admire the skill that it takes to sing Baroque opera and to play Baroque opera. But the more experience I got singing and rehearsing, I just felt like it is like using your voice as an instrument. And it's such a freeing experience to express your emotions vocally as well as physically. So I'm always looking for opportunities to sing more Handel, more Monteverdi.
And so, Bill, for you and looking at what Florentine, where you are, where you want to go, is there going to be more Baroque opera on the bill?
Absolutely. It's funny, in our name, the Florentine Opera is named for the Florentine Camerata. So, you know, we lived most of our lives, the Florentine Opera lived most of its life, smack dab in the middle of the genre. And what I've tried to do is have us live more on the bookends of the genre. And I, for one, you know, I love Rigoletto and Traviata. I always feel that I come to those pieces then with new ears when I start with a world premiere or I do something Baroque. I think it's a great way, in addition to just the value they have on their own, of sort of shaking and scraping some of the barnacles off of what we do in the standard repertory. I think they benefit from that. But I love this genre in particular. I always have. And, you know, we didn't do our first Baroque opera until 2009 with Semele. But I found our audience really likes it. We're in a city where early music now, and now what Jory is doing with Great Lakes Baroque, there's an appetite for it. And plus, again, putting on the executive director's half of my job versus the artistic director, it tends to be a bit more cost-effective than Aida and things like that. So,
no elephants.
In those few instances where art and financial responsibility actually intersect, it's a smart move to seize those when you can. So for me, it hits all the right cylinders. But first and foremost, they're great pieces, and I think our audience deserves to hear from whence we came. And, you know, when you think about how Shakespeare still holds a central place in the theater world, well, I think early opera deserves that same type of flesh and blood approach to it.
So is this the beginning of a beautiful relationship between Great Lakes Baroque and Florentine Opera?
Well, so far, Jory and I have shared drinks, and we haven't thrown harpsichords or stage directions
no
at each other.
Or
so,
anything, yeah.
Actually, the cliche about historically informed musicians is that they tend to be as dry as dust, and not about really supporting and being a part of what happens and being flesh and blood with it. Jory belies all of those stereotypes. He's an incredibly supportive accompanist, both in the real sense of actually playing at the harpsichord, but also how he's approaching the pieces musically. And he really approaches them in a very alive standpoint. It's not pallid.
Academic.
Yeah. Academics.
I never think of academic when I think of you.
Yeah, it's academic. It's academically informed,
yes.
but energetically and very enthusiastically executed. And
I think
that's an important thing. So at least from my standpoint, from the Florentine standpoint, I would certainly hope so, for sure.
Bill makes this very, very easy. We have a beautiful show. He's extraordinarily well prepared. This is a sensitive and beautiful staging. So I feel just like swimming in this. I did want to point out one thing. Bill mentioned that Semele was the first Baroque opera that Florentine did back in 2009. This is the first time that a period instrument orchestra is participating in a Florentine production.
Well, let us end, if we could, with Dido's Lament. And if whoever would like to set up where we are and what is happening, and then we'll set up for the actual performance.
So at this point, Dido and Aeneas had their fight, and she says, "Away to death I'll fly," and she sends him off, and she's told him that she will die without him. So she takes poison, and she kills herself, and this is what she sings after the poison. She's sighing, yeah. And she's speaking to Belinda, saying, "You know, remember me, forget my fate. May my wrongs create no trouble in thy breast." So it's so painfully beautiful, and I'm just so glad to get to sing this. What?
Mezzo-soprano Sandra Pekes-Eddy, accompanied by Jori Vinokur and Ruben Pirinen, performed Dido's Lament from Henry Purcell's opera Dido and Aeneas. The Florentine Opera will perform the entire opera on a double bill with John Blow's Venus and Adonis at the Marcus Center's Vogel Hall this weekend. Bill Florescu is the Florentine's artistic director.
We spoke with him at the Florentine's rehearsal space in River West, and there is more information at WUWM.com. Lots of thanks to Jason Reavy for recording that for us.